Hi, I'm Dave Dufour.
I'm John Schaup.
And I'm Marcia Fulmer. We are theater geeks.
Hello, this is Theater Geeks, the podcast about community theater and the performing arts. And I almost forgot what I was supposed to say there for a second.
Do you know who you are?
I thought my name, I knew my name was part of that intro, but I got up. We've been off for a while. And so it's been a little bit, we just haven't done this for a while because Marcia has been off to Atlantic City.
It's all Marcia's fault.
I did not go to Atlantic City.
Oh, I thought you did. Okay.
It's Long Beach Island.
Long Beach Island. So she's been to the Jersey Shore.
And she brought me back saltwater taffy.
Saltwater taffy. And you saw all kinds of great shows in New York at the same time. What did you see in New York? Just rattle them off.
Lady Day at the Emerson Bar and Grill. I saw one of the last performances of Bullets Over Broadway, which I really loved, and I don't know why it closed. Saw Cabaret and saw Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder.
That's great. Cool. All right. We have a guest with us today, Richard Engling. And Richard is a Chicago-based playwright and author. He is also a co-founder of the Polarity Ensemble Theater. He's also a novelist and musician and director. He's written a number of novels and has directed productions of Absolute Macbeth and The Good Harvest and, of course, the Scottish play. I can say Absolute Macbeth, but I can't say the name all alone, I don't think. I think I'll be okay on that. Yeah. Also adapted and appeared in a production of Antigone. Polarity Ensemble Theater is in Evanston, so it's kind of north of Chicago. But his
actually, we perform in Chicago. Okay. Yes, that's just our offices are in Evanston.
Cool. Well, then, I should say before I go much further, welcome to Theater Geeks. We're really glad to have you here with the podcast.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Your project right now really involves kind of three works. You're calling it a trilogy, but it's not a trilogy of plays. It's a novel by a friend of yours by the name of Firm Chertkow, who passed away in 1988. One of her novels, and a novel of kind of discovery about life and death that you wrote called Visions of Anna, and then most recently a play called Anna in the Afterlife, which kind of they all sort of revolve around Fern Chertkow as kind of a fictionalized character. Is that correct?
Yes. The Annas in both my novel and the play were inspired by Fern. It's definitely fiction. Fern and I came up as fiction writers together. That was the basis of our friendship. These are inspired by Fern, and then there's mm-hmm. the by her. So it gives kind of a kaleidoscopic look of characters that are inspired by one artistic personality.
Right. How do you go about, starting to develop a story? I mean, obviously it starts with story, and then develops into play. And as a novelist and playwright, it sounds like, did you at some point have to make the choice whether this really needed to be another novel or it should be a performing work?
I have written a number of novels and a number of plays over my lifetime. And it seems clear from inception which it's going to be. That a play has to take place in a theater. And there are a lot of things that, there are a lot of ideas that come to you that, don't fit. In fact, when I started writing fiction, a number of my novels, came about because I knew I couldn't fit them in a theater. And I was actually a little frustrated at the beginning because I wanted to be writing plays and my ideas kept coming as novels.
Do you mean because they would have been too long or because production-wise they would have been too big? So they wouldn't fit in theater.
Yeah, it was because so much of the idea had to be internal, had to be thoughts that wouldn't have worked being spoken by actors on a stage.
Okay. Excuse me. Go ahead.
And the idea of even the idea of a, like a narrator would not be sufficient to be able to tell the story.
No, no. The stories were too large in a sense to fit on a stage. You know, the novel and the play is such a different form. A play is really more like a short story than a novel.
Sure.
Why did the trilogy need a third part? It was a duology. Why did the duology need a third part, in your opinion?
Well, you know, these were written over a period of years. Obviously, Fern's book was written before 1988, before she killed herself, and she wrote it with no idea that it would be paired up with anything else. The same was true with my novel, Visions of Anna. I wrote that in the 1990s, inspired by Fern's story and by our friendship. And it was only when I came upon the third idea that became Anna in the Afterlife that it occurred to me that these three things could work together. And I had always wanted to get Fern's work into print. When she died, her parents entrusted me with her manuscripts, and I had in fact tried to get her work into print without success earlier in life. In this case, when I had the third idea for Anna in the Afterlife, which is a different story from Visions of Anna, even though there's some of the same characters, then it seemed that this was a great opportunity to put them all together, to ask an audience to, in fact, experience these three works that were written to be separate and stand entirely separately. The people at Polarity and the other colleagues that we've shown the project to really see that when you put them all together, they illuminate each other in really interesting ways.
So when did you start writing your script?
The script, I think I started writing in 2010. Mm-hmm. And it originally had the title Absolution. It's gone through quite a bit of changes. You know, at Polarity Ensemble Theater, one of the things we're really dedicated to is developing new work. We that's one of our main pursuits. We have a festival of new plays that we do every year called the Dionysus Cup Festival of New Plays. And this is a really serious development process that we take things through. We put out a call for scripts, and we work only with Chicago area playwrights, because part of the practice is to get the playwright in the room with all the other theater artists. So we can't really do it with people from other parts of the country. So we put out a call for scripts, and we'll receive, 60, 70 scripts from local playwrights. We'll decide on four or five of them, and then take those through a full 6-month process. Each playwright is matched up with a director and a dramaturg, and they have a critique session early on, and then there's a period of a few months where the playwright can be working on rewrites, and we will during that time we set up a very informal reading so that the playwright gets the chance to hear professional actors read it in front of a small audience. What our patrons see as the festival itself happens in July, and over a couple of weekends, each of the plays gets two workshop performances where, they've been rehearsed, they've had some rehearsal. It's still script in hand, but we do a nice conversation with the audience, and many playwrights will even bring in new pages for the second performance, which is typically a week later. We had one we had one playwright who had written a particularly long play, and the second week she had cut 45 minutes from the script. Oh, wow. And oh, an entire character.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
So, you know, there can, even in that one week, there can be some.
Well, I would imagine that there are some playwrights who, until they're confronted with it, don't necessarily see that less can be more sometimes. You know, it's you want to say everything. And I'm sure that there's a temptation to try, oh, we can't leave this out and we can't leave that out. And then, you know, when the rhythm of the play is not working, a lot of times the reason is because maybe you need less and that a piece goes in another story. How much do the actors inform the writing and the rewriting?
Oh, you know, the actors are really essential, and the actors we use typically have done this kind of work before. They're accustomed to working with playwrights, and their insights can be really valuable. Mm-hmm. They will discover things that the playwright hasn't thought of very sure. often. And because their focus is so much on the single character in the context of the story, it forces the playwright to confront some things that maybe they haven't completely thought through.
Yeah.
And sometimes also makes the playwright discover things that they've done brilliantly that they didn't even realize they'd done.
Yeah. Well, what works for the actor is very often what works for the character, and the opposite is true too. So I think, you know, it does happen that way, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
In your feedback sessions that you have, then, are you as the writer, how much to your emotional heart do you take that? I mean, do you feel like it's necessary to get that feedback? And I know the reason why I say it is because I've often been asked to read scripts with hopefully a critical eye and give some feedback, and I'm not always sure that the author might be interested in my feedback. How interested are you in the feedback?
I'm always interested in feedback. You know, not all feedback is created equal, obviously.
True.
And sometimes with the best intents, people will not really get where the story is going. And so they'll give you, you know, feedback that isn't really useful. For myself, I've made my living as a writer. You know, I work with clients, and I write advertising and marketing stuff. And I'll sometimes have a client that, you know, wants something that doesn't entirely make sense. But they're the ones who are paying. So mm-hmm. I don't take any of that personally. And that's been good for me as a writer, to learn to not take comments personally. You know, when I'm working with young playwrights, I like to tell them, you know, when people are offering you criticism, think of it like shirts at the Kmart, you know, take a look at them and maybe, you know, maybe there's a nice shirt in there and you want to take that.
Right.
But the rest of them, you don't have to take and you don't have to feel bad about not buying them.
Right.
You just say, thanks for showing me the shirt. And, you know, you don't have to let anyone know whether you're taking the advice or not. Just thank them and move on and realize that, you know, it's not an attack on your soul. And you can use your own judgment as to whether it helps you or not.
You probably undertake a lot of attacks on your own soul, in figuratively speaking, when you're in the writing process. I mean, any good writer kind of learns to be a little bit ruthless with their own material in terms of fixing it, eliminating it, you know, changing it, that kind of thing. Isn't that, do you find that to be true?
Oh, yeah. Well, I enjoy rewriting.
Okay.
Do you really?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
This is our old newspaper person here who's commenting.
Well, I always found that it was much easier to write from scratch if you have, like, if somebody says you can write 10 inches.
Right.
And fit it into there in your own way, rather than writing a big, long thing and they go, oh, you have to cut 10 inches off this. To me, it was always much harder to rewrite than it was to write. So, yeah. You know, obviously that's just me, but
yeah. Well, you know, that marketing thing, there's another place where you have to get, a lot of ideas down
right.
in a few words,
right.
Especially with headlines, you
right.
know.
And it's a whole different thing because obviously they can't tell a playwright, well, you have to have it in so many minutes
right.
or hours or whatever. Whereas, you know, for marketing, they can say this has to be no more than 60 words.
That's right. And they're signing the check.
Fit
so
that.
You have to
yeah.
do it.
Yeah.
yeah. Let me ask you where, now I understand where the idea for the trilogy came from, but mm-hmm. for your other plays, where do you get your ideas?
You know, ideas are all around, aren't they? It all depends on what hits you and what sticks with you. For me personally, you know, there was a novel I wrote that started with a joke in a bar. And I can't even remember what the joke was, but the punchline was trainforcocaine.com.
Oh, jeez. All right.
And if you tried to explain that to us, well, actually you just did and we don't understand it. But
really.
But the point is that obviously you got a novel out of it because it meant something eventually, right?
It did. You know, it's a very odd, I mean, that was a very odd circumstance that a joke just kept gathering story around it somehow, and I stuck with it and actually finished it.
I think every writer is different, though. You get your ideas from certain kinds of things, and another
yeah.
writer comes. And I don't know that there. I've never heard a formula.
No, well, there's all kinds of, you know, another one. I did a play. I did a play called Ghost Watch that was about a haunting, and doing that one, it came from an uncanny experience, personal experience that I had, was quite frightening. And very often it comes that way. It comes out of something in your own life.
Do you save ideas? Like, do you like, I saw a film about Woody Allen once and he had like little slips of paper with movie ideas on them in a drawer.
Yeah.
And it was like, you know, he would, and once he was done writing one and it was in progress as a film, he would go to the drawer and look through all the, it was like a little pile of trash, but they all were ideas.
Not trash to Woody Allen.
No, you're right.
Well, what happens, there are a lot of plays that are commissioned. Like, I have a friend who's a playwright and he was commissioned to write a play about Mary Todd Lincoln to be done at the Ford Center. So is that a whole different process than when you're just using your own imagination? Because obviously this is going to have to be dramatic, but fact-based. Definitely.
Yeah, that would be a whole different kind of project.
What do you think is easier? To write about something that, you know, you can actually research and get your ideas from there, or something that just kind of comes to you like a joke in a bar?
Well, the joke in the bar one, that took some wrangling around because there was no form. There was nothing there. Okay. So as these different bits came, it had to fit into a satisfying plot finally. So that was kind of tricky. I don't think that you can generalize on which one is easier. Sometimes working from history could be, it might be more difficult or it might be easier depending on how dramatic the actual occurrences were. I think it's project by project. I know one thing though is that projects earlier in your life as a writer are harder than ones later. Once you've written 500,000 words, it gets easier to write.
Okay. Keep that in mind.
You know, and when you think about how many things you write and throw away, it doesn't take as long to get to a half a million words as that sounds.
Getting back to the workshop process, I'm curious about just how that works. If what's a typical first day with the actors when you're going to workshop something? What do you say to them, and how do you approach it? What are the ground rules that you set up with a cast the first day, whether you're workshopping your own work or another new work?
You know, I'd like to tell the actors and the directors and the dramaturg not to be too much in love with their ideas. What we have to trust in the end is that the very best version of this play is going to come from the playwright. And what we're there to do is to offer that playwright inspiration, you know. And one of the things I'll tell the playwrights as well is pay more attention to the point in the script people are talking about than what they're actually saying. Because if they're offering suggestions, you know, the suggestions may be for an imagined play in their heads rather than the play that ought to be written.
Right.
But there's likely something at that point in the play they're talking about that needs work.
Right. They may be making a suggestion, but what they're really doing is identifying an issue.
Yeah, identifying an issue, and they can identify, they can be pretty accurate about where the issue is.
Right.
They aren't necessarily going to always be helpful about how to solve that issue. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I try to get my actors not to argue too hard for what they think ought to be, because the playwright will, in the end, have the clearest vision of where the thing ought to go.
Well, and it has to come from the playwright's voice ultimately, anyhow. Otherwise, it doesn't work within the overall context. Yeah.
So Richard, with your upcoming play, which opens next April up in Chicago, mm-hmm. and in the Afterlife, are you done with the whole process, or are you still in the process of rewriting?
You know you're done when it's opening night.
Okay. Yeah. Do you have any more workshopping to do on that show?
Yeah, we will. We definitely will. Mm-hmm. And you know, that play, I mean, I have some wonderful colleagues I work with at the theater, so I've been able to go back and forth between individual critique sessions with my colleagues and you know, staged reading sorts of things. And there's a woman named Ann Keen who founded the company with me, and she's really astute. She's worked in the entire time we've been working together, and Polarity has been running for almost 11 years now. And she and I were friends before that. In all of that time, she's always read the drafts of my work and given me really detailed suggestions. And, you know, that sort of thing is fantastic. Susan Padbean, who's going to be directing for me, she also gives me great feedback, and some of the other people in the company will give me feedback, some of my fellow playwrights. And then, of course, you know, the process of having actors read it. But those individual sessions over a glass of wine are actually where I've made the biggest leaps in my work.
Yeah, wine helps.
Well, you know, we don't call it the Dionysus Cup Festival of New Plays
for nothing. Yeah,
I was going to say. I should tell you, the Polarity Ensemble Theater just won a Jeff Award for world premiere of the play that you produced and did you direct the play as well?
No.
Never the Bridesmaid by Bill Jepson. So that's a great honor. For those of you who are listening in Pakistan, the Joseph Jefferson Award is also known as the Jeff Award in Chicago. And it's the sort of the Tony Awards for the Chicago region. So right. Congratulations on that.
Yeah, we were very pleased with that. And in fact, we just opened another world premiere last weekend. Mm-hmm. And Richard Shavson, who directed Never the Bridesmaid, is also directing this world premiere. So I was very pleased to work with Richard again. He had a wonderful rapport with the playwright last year and now Chuck O'Connor, playwright of Miracles in the Fall. Okay. So, we love. And both of those plays came through the Dionysus Cup Festival. Once it's gone through the festival and then we produce it, we're doing a full year or more of development on a script by the time it hits the stage.
Well, we've been talking to Richard Engling, who is the co-founder and artistic director of the Polarity Ensemble Theater and is currently in workshops for Anna in the Afterlife, a play that he has written based on the life and of a friend, Fern Chertkow, who passed away a number of years ago. It is a trilogy when combined with her novel and his novel of previous years. And the play starts running April 23rd to May 24th, 2015 in the Chicago. What theater will it be in?
We are now a resident company at the Greenhouse Theater Center in Lincoln Park.
Okay, great. Oh, that's right near north there. Perfect.
Yeah. It's a wonderful space that has been in operation since the end of the 60s. Mm-hmm. It was first known as the Body Politic, and then it was Victory Gardens. And then, of course, Victory Gardens took over the old Biograph Theater.
Yes.
And our theater became known as the Greenhouse Theater Center. So we're delighted to be there. It's a wonderful space with four theaters and lots going on.
Well, for those of you in the Midwest region, of course, Chicago's got a lot of great theater going on. And Lincoln Park area is actually pretty accessible and easy to get around in. So it's a good thing to think about in terms of not just this play, but other plays get to Chicago and see something. We can follow you at, of course, it looks like you and the theater are on Facebook and Facebook basically, and also in looks like LinkedIn or something like that. Also richardengling.com, petheater.com is the theater company, and there's also a blog that's associated with that. We'll have all those links up on our show notes for the website when this episode appears on the intertubes, as we like to say. So yeah, right.
It's the first time I've heard it.
Anyway, well, thank you very much for being with us, Richard, and good luck with the play and with the further work that you're doing on the whole trilogy.
Yeah, one of the things I'd like to mention is that as we're releasing the two books, we're doing a series of Reader's Theater events to launch them, us being a theater company as well as doing the publishing. And we're also setting up some book clubs. We really want to work with book clubs on this project because it's such an interesting thing to be able to read two books and then go and see a play. And we would set up, special talkbacks for the book clubs to talk about the experience of doing the whole thing. And we're even setting up an online book club so that people around the country can get in on this, and we'll, we're going to figure out a way that they can experience the play even from a distance.
Right. Well, you should have your publicity person, Angel Barbizon, who is with your publicity firm, is the person who contacted us about you originally, and we'll stay in touch with her, and she can give us some details of those things as they develop.
Great.
So, anyway, well, thank you very much, and good luck, and we will talk to you perhaps down the road.
Thank you, David.
All right. Thank you.
Paul. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And now it's time for Marcia's pet peeve
day. Yeah, because she has one.
She has one today.
I don't know if it's the pet peeve of the year, but it's definitely today.
I will decide. Well, I'll tell you what. We'll listen, and we'll decide if it's a pet peeve for the year or just this week.
But it's not just mine. It has to be everybody's. It was reinforced, and I think I've talked about this before. It was definitely reinforced by my experiences in New York with the theater going public, which is no better than the theater going public around here, in that they have no idea that when the lights go down and for the musical, when the music starts, the play, the musical is going to begin. So they stand in the lobby or they stand in the aisles. And then when the curtain goes up, all of a sudden it dawns on them that they better get their butts in their seats. And they cross all, they're always in the middle of the row, always right down front. So you get this chain reaction of heads up, down, up, down, up, down, while you're trying to watch the play. And at those prices, they should be in their seats.
You know, John, I give that an 8.
I didn't know we were ranking, but you better. I mean, I feel the same way, though.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
It's just bad.
There's no excuse.
Well, and for me especially, a musical starts with the music because there's a reason why it's there. It's there to prepare you for the melodies that are going to be coming up in the show.
Exactly.
It's there to create a mood. You almost always get a feel if the show is going to be a musical drama or a musical comedy from the opening overture.
What I don't understand, I mean, they start the overture after lights go down.
Right.
I don't think you're necessarily totally black, but you're they're way down.
No.
And the lights go down, that means shut up
and sit down.
It does not mean, oh dear, I have to talk louder to be heard over the music.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I think it's a strange cultural shift that has been propagated by television.
It's also a hard thing because theater is a place where we want people to have a social night. You know, you come with your friends a lot of times, or your family
during the show,
but you don't talk during the show. And there's a certain, we always talk about theater etiquette, and one of those theater etiquettes is you must sit down before the lights go down.
Oh, geez. You know? Yes.
Also, don't sing along with the overture. That's another thing not to do.
Well, I've been known to hum.
Well, that wraps up this episode of Theater Geeks.
Thank you, David.
We hope that you are finding us on all the places that fine podcasts are distributed, including iTunes, including Apple TV, including the Blueberry Network, TuneIn Radio, Stitcher On Demand Radio, and every place else that fine podcasts are sold. And so listen to us everywhere.
Yeah, and you can go to our store, our
online store. What about our store, John?
Actually, when I went to New Jersey, I carried 2 Theater Geek coffee mugs as gifts for the hostess.
That, you know, the coffee mugs are probably the top seller.
Well, I think
they're
what we should do is
nice.
We should just get rid of the underwear altogether and just sell the mugs.
I don't know. You just mentioned it again, so we may have a run on the underwear. There we go. That wasn't exactly the right wording, was it? Never mind. anyway, yes, go to our store. We got all kinds of stuff. We got clocks. You got a clock, didn't you? Yep, you got a clock. She's got the clock. She's got the mugs. She's got a couple of the teddy bears.
Oh. She and I are wearing our t-shirts today.
We are wearing our t-shirts today.
Unfortunately, I'm not. 2 out of 3 is pretty good, but I messed up. So that's all from us. I'm Dave Dufour.
I'm John Schaup.
And I'm Marcia Fulmer. And we are Theater Geeks.
Music for Theater Geeks was provided by MusicAlley.com.
Theater Geeks is a production of the Dufour Creative Network.